Coming up, a special episode of the Ideas Lab podcast, What It Means to Be, presented by Dr. Yan Wong.
Hello, and welcome to this Ideas Lab Predictor Podcast special edition on what it means to be fit. We've got four guests here, and they are under starter's orders, ready to race into discussion, so let me introduce them. Alice Wright is Senior Dietitian at the Heart of England Foundation Trust.
Hi.
From the University of Birmingham, we have Professor Janice Thompson from the School of Sport, Exercise and Rehabilitation Sciences.
Hello.
And Dr. Ami Banerjee from the Centre for Cardiovascular Sciences.
Hello, Jan.
And finally, we have Dr. Ab Tarani from the School of Clinical and Experimental Medicine.
Hi.
Fantastic to see you all. I've got a piece of paper in front of me here that says government recommendations for adults is 2.5 hours of moderate intensity activity in bouts of 10 minutes or more per week. And there should be an effort to minimise being sedentary for long periods. We're all sitting down, aren't we? So my first question, I guess, is how fit do you all think you are?
I'm actually finding out how fit or unfit I am at the moment because I'm doing a week of charity runs to raise money for the Teenage Cancer Trust in East Yorkshire. And we've done 3 10Ks and it's the first time I've run any distance like that in a couple of years. So I think fulfilling the requirements on a regular basis and practice is quite important to know how fit you are.
Impressive. Anyone else?
Well, I walk to work. I walk every single day. I don't have a car. Despite my accent, you would assume I do have a car because I had to have one for the first 42 years of my life. But since I've moved to the UK, I've been an active commuter. So I walk a minimum of an hour every day. That would be to and from work, you know, total. And then do other exercise as well. But as I've gotten older, I don't compete like I used to. However, I still just engage regularly. So for me, it's kind of about the lifestyle fitness that we all try to promote, and that works for me.
We're doing well so far. Anyone else, Alice?
I attend group exercise classes twice a week, but more for the social side of things rather than to purposely go there to get fit. It's about having fun, being happy, meeting new friends. But I wouldn't really class myself as fit, but it's a very subjective measure, isn't it? It's how do you define fit?
I guess that's what we're going to be talking about.
I can climb a flight of stairs without getting out of breath. However, I couldn't do a 10K run. So
my job is mainly office-based, so the only exercise I get is when I go to the gym, and I do that 5 days a week between 1.5 hours and 2 hours. But that's pretty much all the exercise I get. Outside that time, I'm pretty sedentary.
Well, it sounds pretty good. Well, we went out and asked people we met how fit they think they are.
My current level of fitness is dire.
Descending, getting back to couch potato status.
Not as fit as I'd like to be. I'm fairly fit, but not that fit.
I'm reasonably fit.
Not especially fit. It's not unfit.
Average to poor.
Very poor. I'm very unfit. I don't go to the gym.
No exercises involved. I walk to work and back, but that's about it.
I'm really lazy.
I am plain and simple lazy.
I haven't got the time.
I like my bed too much.
I work hard at work. The last thing I want to do is go home and do anything.
Time. Finding time to go to the gym.
I'd love to be one of the people that can get up at 6 o'clock and go to the gym before work or go for a run after work, but I like just coming home and chilling. I just can't be bothered.
I don't live walking distance to a gym or a swimming pool.
Financially, I find that very hard.
I've had some exams recently.
I'm very lazy.
A personal injury.
If I had another dog, that would in fact make me fitter because I would take the dog out and walk every day.
Get home and I think, oh, shall I go on the way fit? And I think, no, I sit outside in the sun.
There's a lot of guilty people out there, aren't there? Do you think that's typical?
Of feeling guilty, you mean?
Well, yeah, and the people who were talking to us.
I mean, I think the other common thing I picked up kind of a thread throughout was that everyone assumed to be fit you have to go to the gym, that it has to be a certain time of day. Mm-hmm. So they had quite a narrow idea of what, you know, getting fit or being fit or being regularly active is really about. So I think that's probably quite common, is there's a bit of a misperception, so then people just can't move forward because they say, well, I can't achieve that, so I'm not even going to try.
Yeah. I also heard something that I've definitely felt in the past, that exercise, if you're not in the habit of it, it's not part of your routine, or you're not doing something like Janice's walking to work, it can be seen as a chore, as something that's definitely not fun, and therefore is priority number 10 on your list after all the other things that you do, and so that perception of exercise is really important in staying fit, I think.
And I guess this is something that you are all, you four probably, are meeting all the time with people, how you get them to to get to have a fit and healthy lifestyle, but without making them feel like they have to go to the gym or do all those sorts of things.
It's about thinking outside the box as well. So like you said, people associate fitness with going to the gym, but actually if they just get off a bus stop one earlier, park further away, doing small activities like that, if they're going to buy some milk rather than getting in the car to go to the big supermarket, go to your corner shop, you know, and incorporating activity into your daily lifestyle.
That's all just slightly more inconvenient though, isn't it? Are they going to do it?
A lot of them do.
Yeah?
A lot of them do. If they're motivated to lose weight and become fit, they do.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them do, actually.
And I actually think, again, convenience is very, it's a perception.
Yeah.
It's actually probably takes more time to get into the car, start it, drive it, park, get out, go into the shop, and then you've done the driving time. Yeah. Much more convenient and much quicker to go down to the corner shop, most likely, when you actually roll it all together.
Also, your frame of mind as well. So you could have got in your car, had a bit of road rage, couldn't find a car parking space. had some difficulties getting there, whereas you could have a nice walk. You come back feeling much more refreshed, has some fresh air in your lungs, you feel much better about yourself.
So or a chest infection if the weather is bad. Or you get a chest infection in your lungs if the weather is bad.
Depending where you go.
And which summer or autumn, yeah.
But it seems like, so you, Alice, you're saying that mental fitness is a sort of useful, very important thing to take account of as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's about health and well-being. Mm-hmm. Somebody could run a marathon quite easily, but if they're not mentally stable, not mentally fit, then are they really fit? Is that that term fitness, I think, is very subjective.
It is very poorly defined, and yes. It is a holistic picture. You know, you can fit in one aspect, but not the other. But, theoretically, mental and physical fitness, a lot of the time go hand in hand, but not all the time. And it's important to have both fitness on board. One of them and not the other is still very difficult.
Mm. So are there specific instances where you've seen, or is that true from a large amount of your caseload that you need to sort of tackle the mental side of things as well?
Especially working with the obese population, they need to be in the right frame of mind to make behaviour and lifestyle changes in order to decrease their weight and also to get fit as well. The right frame of mind is key.
You can see that at the other end of the spectrum. I see, for example, many women during reproductive age who are absolutely fit and well and healthy, but they perceive themselves not to be fit and healthy and they're overweight. And actually, they try to bring their weight excessively down, which is damaging their health. So the mental well-being with that mental physical fitness would have been brilliant. But obviously, they don't have the mental well-being. They still drive their weight down and lower and lower. So mental well-being is an essential part of the picture.
So that's quite interesting. It sounds like the sort of lower end of the spectrum, people who are unhealthily thin or are not eating enough, have the same sort of problems as the people who are at the top end of the spectrum, overly obese.
I think that's definitely my experience. That first of all, as people have said, that health and well-being are kind of tied into this idea of fitness and exercise, and you can't look at things in isolation. And definitely, you can be too low in weight, and if you're doing lots of exercise and not having good nutrition and looking after the other aspects of your health, then that can actually be counterproductive. So somehow we have to have an overall picture of health and fitness rather than just often when you speak to the general public, they think of just how much you go to the gym or how much you go running as your fitness, which is not accurate, I think.
I would love to get away from the term fitness, because fitness means gym. Exercise. Yeah. It would be better, it would be more helpful from a clinician point of view to say health at every size, no matter what size you are, promote a healthy lifestyle.
I'm going to bring in a little different view.
Good.
I think discussions, you know, definitely overall, you know, fully agree. I just think we want to remember the context. Fitness does actually have technical terms. It has a number of technical terms, which makes it confusing to the general public. We have different components of fitness, cardiovascular respiratory fitness, which, you know, we can measure on a treadmill. There's fitness around body composition. There's fitness around flexibility. There's fitness around strength, muscle strength and endurance. Those are all really critical components of fitness. I don't want to minimize them. It's just we don't also want to use it as, a tool to beat people over the head to say, unless you achieve all of these at the highest level. And I think that's where general people come from. They think if they're not that fit, then they've not achieved fitness, and that's not true. So I think part of it is maybe more of a compromise between the terms we use and how we apply them, and getting people to understand that bigger concept of, you know, sport performance is critical and you have to have a certain level of fitness to achieve it, but that doesn't mean we all have to be elite athletes, not at all. That's just part of the picture of fitness. And some elite athletes are incredibly healthy and they're optimally performing at every level. Other athletes, as you know, I mean, you were just saying that some people take it to the extreme. You know, they're hurting their bodies, you know, low bone density, you know, women are, you know, sometimes starving themselves, if you will, to meet a certain criteria that actually isn't really about fitness. That's probably about a mental and emotional state of poor health. That, and they just use exercise as a tool, and they use food as a tool to achieve that. But exercise and food itself is not the demon. That's not the devil. It's the tool that they use to achieve control or some sense of control that they think they're getting.
It is a sort of psychological thing then, isn't it? Yeah. And what you're saying is that you think it can be a useful psychological tool to say people need to achieve a certain amount of fitness, whereas Alice was saying maybe psychologically it's not very helpful and you should aim at something else. It's not really to do with the medical side of things. It's to do with how you change behaviour.
Isn't it? I'm working with the obese population, so we can't come in and say, right, we need to measure, you know, your VO2 max and things like that. Whereas if you're working with a normal weight population, a healthy BMI, then okay, maybe go in with that, the bigger tactics that you're
using. What does work for? What does work for people who are morbidly obese?
There's a lot of individualisation there. I mean, I think they're both right in their views. I mean, the issue is that for some people, you're absolutely right. You need actually to shock them. Shocking people about their reality sometimes work, but doesn't work for every type of personality. And what we see with patients, and Alice, I'm sure, will probably agree with that, is that we just don't have one size fit all. It's really we try the patient to find their own way about how to share their life. Rather, we don't tell them how to share their life. We try to think along with them to how to change their life. They need to come up with the answer rather than us, because we don't know how their life is. No matter how much I spend time with them in the clinic, taking the most detailed history in the world, I still wouldn't know how it is for them on day-to-day basis. And that's where the healthy lifestyle is going to be, on day-to-day basis. They need to come up with the answers. All what we try to do is to support them to come up with the answers. And we encourage them to do what they wanted to do.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It is a lot of work.
We're really careful with our words when we talk to our patients. Mm-hmm. So as Ab said, we get them to come up with their own ideas. So we'd say, what needs to change? What could you do? What could be different? So rather than being very directive in what they need to change, it's about them coming up with their own ideas. And that's when we see the change in behaviour.
So those are people who are morbidly obese, and obesity in general causes quite a lot of problems in the UK.
The idea of morbidly obese is there actually many people who have diseases related to obesity and die from heart attacks. They are not morbidly obese. They are obese, but not morbidly obese. So we have a lot of morbidly obese who have no medical problems.
And some of them aren't even obese. Exactly. The bottom line is heart disease.
Yeah, just overweight.
Not even overweight. I mean, there's a lot of risk factors for heart disease.
I was on call just last weekend. I can tell you we had a 45-year-old man who is as fit as it can be, and he's coming with an acute heart attack. So. Yeah. But
it still predisposes you one way or the other, doesn't it?
What I mean is, as soon as your weight goes up into the overweight range, definitely into the obese range, then your risk rockets up.
Yeah.
You don't need actually to be at that morbid obese range. It's just from the obesity start of, from BMI of 30, your risk goes up.
And I guess obesity is just an indicator of your cardiovascular health, and there are other things that are also indicators of it. You must see this all the time, Amy.
Yeah, I would say, rather than an indicator, there's various risk factors, as Ab is alluding to, and obesity is one of the risk factors. And as a cardiologist in my clinical job, I advise people to try and reduce their risk as much as they can in terms of these various risk factors, whether that is obesity or smoking or diet or exercise, for that matter. And I think it might be helpful to talk about two different types of people that we see in our job in the hospital. That we have people who we're trying to get healthy before they have an event, before they have something like a heart attack. In my case, we're trying to prevent those heart attacks. That's what we call primary prevention. And so this idea of people getting healthy, going to the gym, managing their diet and other risk factors, not smoking in the first place, is trying to reduce the risk of those things happening. But actually, I spend most of my time seeing people who have had heart attacks or strokes, and so they're the emphasis is different to get them healthy, to reduce the risk of further events, and to get them back to the best that they can be and have as good a quality of life as possible. So that's what we would call, say, secondary prevention. And they're both equally important, and really, I'd say, arguably, the latter population of people that after a heart attack, you'd hope that that's the time when people are most receptive to lifestyle change. That isn't always the case, but that's a real opportunity for us as you know, health professionals to try and get people on the bandwagon of thinking about their health and their fitness.
But presumably you'd prefer to do the primary one if you could. You'd prefer people not to have heart attacks at all,
yeah.
and to absolutely stop them in the first place.
Absolutely. There's actually no doubt that it would be better to have no heart attacks. But I think one of the issues with trying to change people's lifestyle when they haven't had an event or haven't seen anybody who's had an event is that somehow it seems like something that's not happened to them or anybody they know. And so, perversely, there's less incentive for them to take on these healthy behaviours. Whereas if you had somebody who was obese who had a heart attack, then they might be, with their personal situation, much more involved and much more able to see that, gosh, if I don't change, then this is going to happen again. And that's what we do see day to day. So I think I would echo what people have said, that you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all, and we do individualise, not just predicting the risk, but also how we tackle those risks after heart attacks or other things.
And it's not just heart attacks, I presume. There must be a whole host of things, strokes and even things like Alzheimer's and stuff, I guess. Yeah. Depends on your...
These are all diseases or conditions that affect the circulatory system or the arteries, if you like, and so absolutely it can affect almost any organ of the body.
Well, but Amy brings up an important point. Really, in some cases, you need to change people's behavior as quickly as possible because they're at extremely high risk. Others, you know, maybe in a way, I guess you could argue they have a bit more time. But I think that's the hard bit, because there is no one way to change behavior, and there's not one trigger that influences humans to want to do that. To get individuals to change behavior isn't going to change public health levels. So if we want to see it on a countrywide level or a nation level, that's probably a whole different approach than what we're trying to do here on a day-to-day basis in, you know, whether it's clinical practice, whether it's the advice we might give to individuals who just come to us. So I think that's the other tricky bit, is how we tease all of that out and figure it out. And nobody has the one answer that's going to work.
Sort of, yeah.
Exactly.
I think we've got some clips, actually, of what people think are the biggest barriers to us all being fitter.
I think it's...
Most people are lazy.
I think everybody's lazy. It's the cost of everything. It's having to pay phenomenal fees for the gym.
The gym's ridiculously expensive. And they're boring, I think.
There are no healthy idols. There's nothing really which pushes kids to want to go out and be as healthy as they can be.
There's not a lot of place where for children to go as well as parents.
The values of physical fitness aren't really sort of ingrained into people enough from a young age. There's a lot of advertising from high sugar, high fat food manufacturers.
It's so easy to go home from work and then sit in front of the television and...
Computers, tablets, television.
People that just don't have the motivation to go out and do something that would help them get fitter.
If you're unfit and then you want to get fit, there is this 2 to 3 week agony that you have to go through, where you really have to push yourself and push yourself to actually get to a stage where it's comfortable to exercise.
So I was wondering if it's changed much recently, because you do get the idea from those clips and also from, I guess, personal experience, that society has changed such that people feel that they're less fit and they probably are. And there's some stats from the US where they try and identify the sort of healthiest cities in the US, and the ones that come out on top are twin cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and supposedly that's because they have lots of playground facilities and outdoor activities, making it easy for people to take part in healthy activities that keep them fit. Is that, do you think that's a major factor in what's changed in society here?
I think humans don't really want to be active. I think you have to, I mean, we've been active for our entire beginning of time because we had to be. We had to be to eat. Yeah. We had to be to survive and move away from danger. So now that we no longer have those sorts of traditional dangers and we don't have to hunt and gather our food for the most part other than going to the supermarket, that cynical side of me says, in a way, maybe we're not designed for leisure activity. Mm-hmm. Now, I say that, and of course, probably 15 to 25% of a lot of Western cultures do engage in leisure activity. So there is a proportion of us, and some of us are sitting at this table now, who will engage with that. But I like the stat you brought up about the fittest cities in the U.S. They do it every year. It's fantastic. It's become a bit of a point of pride and I think a competition there for cities to want to get on that list of the more fit, not the least fit. But typically, the most common barriers, like the clip was saying, either people say they're lazy or not motivated, but the other one is the environment or weather. And I find it interesting that the fittest city is one of the coldest and has the harshest weather in the U.S. Minneapolis-St. Paul region is in Minnesota. It's cold. Oh, my God. They get massive snowstorms and they get blizzards. And
but
it
they
is
still
not,
go out.
They still, well, and, now, granted, they're probably not going out in those snowstorms because you will die. Believe me, I know I've had to exercise in Toledo, Ohio in December. The things you will do for the people you love. But anyway, it's not easy. So they've done it, but also, you know, there's places, of course, in Colorado and California. Yeah. So I think it's not just the environment you have. We can change part of our environments, but I'm thinking like weather and stuff. It's not maybe your response to it or how resilient or the things we can change and then getting people to change their perception of the environment that maybe it's not as difficult as they assume it is. But from that clip, I can tell people just think it's impossible.
Resilience is lacking, basically. Yeah. I mean, there's no resilience at all. There's no that desire to defeat that barrier.
But to play devil's advocate, I have some young children. And whenever you go and see young children, they're always playing and running around. So it's not a 15 to 20% of people who want to actually do exercise. It seems to be 100% when you're age 5 or 6 or 7 who are out trying to do their effectively their hunter-gatherer activities or practicing for it. And so you perhaps we lose something when as we get older.
Absolutely. I mean, with the society, with the schools, with the media, you just lose the way how we live, the way how we have to earn money. They lose that as they go along. And it's difficult to go back. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to go back.
I think somebody in the clip mentioned role models, and some of those are personal role models, which might come from family members. So I can anecdotally speak of friends who've been going out hiking and running with their parents since they were toddlers, and that's something that they've carried through with them with their children. Whereas actually with my parents, exercise was not a big part of our activity together, and so that was something I did with other people or through school. And actually, we've gone full circle, and I go out for long walks with my dad now.
Broken the circle.
Yeah. So I think role models are really, really important indeed. And there's this idea of personal versus social responsibilities that actually, at some stage, an individual is responsible. We can, as a society and as a healthcare system, put as many tools and as much in their environment to make it possible, but somebody has their own choice to make that first step to make a lifestyle change, and we can't force that.
I guess as a doctor, you've just got to put the options in front of them and say these are the consequences of what you do.
And sometimes making it palatable. I mean, as Abd said, for some people, giving the stick is more successful than the carrot, but sometimes I find actually incremental carrots, if you will. So for example, when getting people to stop smoking, people often talk about the kind of going cold turkey, just waking up one day after your heart attack and stopping smoking. But I've found that's relatively uncommon, and some people would rather cut down gradually and say so 2 cigarettes a day is definitely better than 20 cigarettes a day, and that will hopefully lead to stopping altogether. And similarly, nobody's going to start running 10K or swimming lots of lengths overnight. And if you present it as you've got to be either an Olympic athlete or not, then nobody would exercise, and we have to find ways of making these things accessible.
Are the carrots incremental enough, though? Because is there much of a benefit if you are unfit from just doing that little bit of extra exercise? Do you see? Because I imagine there's lots of people out there who would think, well, if I go for a 10-minute run, I'll be completely knackered at the end of it. And then I won't necessarily see much of a health benefit because I need to be able to be doing a lot more than that.
I can speak from a very personal view in the last couple of days that I'm not somebody who goes out running very much at all. And both the health aspect and the social aspect of going out doing exercise with a group of people definitely make me feel much better than I did last week when I wasn't doing any running at all. And I think the difficulty is that when you have to step that up by yourself or you're left without that framework, then it might be more difficult. I think that there's no question that you get both mental and physical well-being from the small, even small increments.
Well, how do you find the time to do it?
I was going to say, following up, the evidence actually does indicate that the biggest improvement you get in your health is to go from doing nothing to doing something. Right. That's actually the biggest jump when you look at improvements in terms of whether it's risk of premature mortality, whether it's risk for cardiovascular disease, whatever it is. The biggest improvement you get is for going from nothing to a bit of something.
So that's really actually,
that is exactly. And the rest of us who are somewhere in the middle of that, we're doing stuff, but maybe we would like to do more. We still get some benefit, but the biggest jump, the biggest improvement is that move. So, and that's, I think, a message people don't get. You're right. They think they have to do a certain amount. And how do they do it? And it doesn't have to, you were just saying time. It doesn't have to be massive amounts of time. Again, you do not have to exercise an hour and a half to 2 hours a day to get the benefit. We were just saying 10-minute chunks.
And that sense of achievement, once they have gone from nothing, like you say, to just improving ever so slightly, just from my patient's experience, recently a patient called me up and said they'd never been able to run for longer than 15 seconds, and now she was running for 60 seconds. And she was just so proud of herself, and she took ownership of her health, and she felt the need to call me just to tell me that she'd run for 60 seconds without stopping, and hopefully it's going to progress from there.
It is very important to set up those realistic aims. I mean, we see a lot of people who are quite big. There are physical barriers for them actually to exercise. There are body image barriers for them to exercise. They've never exercised before. And for them, the idea of exercise is such a, very, very, very high mountain. There is no, this is a huge barrier for them. And just to set exercise in the logical context to them, in the sense is that it's not what you see on TV. It's not going to the gym. And it's actually probably just walking just walking out for 5 minutes with the dog. That is an exercise to you. And this is an achievement that you can increase as time. But again, the question does come up. Does that actually make a difference if I walked for 5 minutes? Maybe just actually the actual walking for 5 minutes may not make a difference, but it is the start of something that will make a difference. And it is the huge, huge first step, as Janice said.
And if you were to be able to implement one thing to sort of improve the fitness of people in the UK, what would it be?
Prioritize it. Make it a part of the daily culture. You know, our daily culture currently is we're required, and I'm me included, and I hate it. My job demands that I sit for 8 to 12 hours every day. I write, I prepare lectures, I have to write articles. I mean, even when I teach, I'm not standing up for massive amounts of time. So I think it is a culture shift to say activity should be a part of our daily lives, and it can come in a bunch of different forms. It can come in sport, it can come in other activities. But the bottom line is, until we make that huge shift and the car is no longer king, and because basically our environments are set up to make sure we drive everywhere, and I think that's really, really challenging. So I'm a bit more, I don't want to punish people. That's what I'm against. I'm against taxing people and punishing them and making them pay more because somehow their health is, I mean, a lot of people, their health is poor because they're deprived as well. But the last thing we want to do is punish them for that. But I think that culture shift has to come from a wide range of levels, and we just keep expecting those individuals to make change, and somehow they're going to overcome everything. And I think it's a compromise. I think it's a partnership, really, of how do you make your environment and your areas more active to promote that, and then getting the people to engage in it as well. And it's long term.
How do other people think? What would you do if you were Prime Minister or whatever?
Well, if I'm a Prime Minister, it's a different game. But
well, yes,
it will be very interesting. But I totally echo what Janice said. It is at the moment, it is something that they have to think about and prepare the time to do it, and then they do it. That's a lot of hassle. It needs to be part of the, as they wake up and have breakfast routinely without thinking about it, they will wake up and exercise without thinking about it. We need to get there. As long as we are planning the exercise and we try to make it, well, I have to find the time, and then I have to have the money to go to the gym, although I'm totally against attaching gym to the word exercise. Yeah. But as you can see, everybody almost you've spoken to on that clip, they all seem to see that. You know, finding the money, finding the time. I need to find somebody to take care of my children while I'm in the gym. It's too much hassle. People are not going to do it. People at the end of the day like easy things. But in order for exercise to be easy, it needs to be part of the routine life. At the moment, it isn't. You know, when I go down to London and for several meetings and events, quite commonly I see people running around the lunchtime and coming back to the office with their, you know, with their mm-hmm. running kit. I just don't see that in Birmingham, for example, not that often. Mm-hmm. So, for those people, exercise over lunch is just part of their routine now. They go to work, they can change their kit easily at work for however, whatever infrastructure they have, I don't know. Mm-hmm. They go and run and come back over lunch. Brilliant. There's no problem about it. They didn't have to think about when am I going to do it. By the end of the day, I'm too tired. I need to go and pick up the children and the rest of it.
So, Alice, how would you bring about culture shift?
I think companies as well have a large part to play to change the culture of our working environment. For example, lunchtimes. I don't think I'd be able to go for a run at lunchtime. But if we made it a rule, for example, that go for a 10-minute walk before you go and have your lunch and sit down, and everybody in the office has to leave their desk for 10 minutes to go for a walk around the block before they eat. I think small changes like that would promote being fitter, being healthier.
Sounds quite an imposition from the top, though. Kick everyone out of the office for 10 minutes.
I think it's not just about physical fitness, is it? It's about mentality as well. Yeah. You're going to come back to your desk feeling a lot more refreshed and ready to start the afternoon of work.
I don't think it's any more of an imposition pushing down from the top to say that basically I have to sit at my desk until that job gets done. Yeah. That's the same thing. Mm-hmm. I don't get paid unless that work gets done, mm-hmm. which demands I sit at my desk for an astronomical mm-hmm. number of hours. So to me, I mean, wherever that motivation comes from, or support.
Support.
It's support,
support
really.
Support is a better word.
You're not going to get fired if you don't do it. Yeah. You know, we're not saying that. But.
Not yet. Ami, what do you do?
I would say that culture is easier to change when there's facilities, either parks, open spaces, somewhere to walk nearby, God forbid, gym or, a swimming pool. And these are things that actually are available but are often underused in our communities, and mm-hmm. whether we can get links between the workplace and otherwise. And then secondly, I would say that we have to be very creative in our own workplaces. And sometimes they're very small things that can have a big impact. For example, in the hospital I work in, there's seven floors, and it's a very, very easy decision to make when the lift arrives to go from floor number one to floor number seven. But even if I every time decide that I'm going to go up three of those flights of stairs, and there's not many lifts, and I end up, as Janice said earlier, sometimes that decision to take lift can take longer than actually going up. But actually, if everybody's doing that, and there's almost a culture shift, and sometimes we go on ward rounds where some of the doctors are almost forcing you to use the stairs, which might sound very draconian, but actually that forces you to do something that you otherwise wouldn't do.
And I think you're not treating your colleagues as well.
Yes, absolutely right.
And that cultural component is very important. Yeah. You go to Scandinavia and everybody riding cycles, or everybody is on a bike. We just hardly ever see it here. And it's more dangerous even in the UK to do it.
So that's what we need to do then, change of culture, I guess. Mm-hmm. I hope you found that interesting. I certainly did. I'll just go off and run around the block then. Alice, Janice, Ami, Abd, thank you very much.
This Ideas Lab Predictor podcast was presented by Dr. Jan Wong. It was produced by Lucy Vernal and Sam Walter and is part of a series from the University of Birmingham.